plant's vitamins, minerals, protein, and fiber. This food, regular sugar, white flour, etc., has very little nutritional value. Foods such as pastas made from refined flour, sugary cereals, white bread, candies, and sugar-laden soft drinks should be avoided as much as possible. But do eat whole, complex, carbohydrate-containing foods such as unprocessed fresh fruits and vegetables, and whole grain products like brown rice and oatmeal. These unprocessed carbohydrates, especially from fruits and vegetables, are exceptionally health-promoting. You may have heard that calcium is beneficial in fighting colon cancer. This, of course, gets extended to the argument that cow's milk fights colon cancer. It has been hypothesized that high-calcium diets prevent colon cancer in two ways. First, by inhibiting the growth of critical cells in the colon, and second, by binding up intestinal bile acids. These acids arise in the liver, move to the intestine, and are thought to get into the large bowel and promote colon cancer development. By binding these bile acids, calcium is said to prevent colon cancer. One research group demonstrated that high-calcium diets, generally meaning diets high in dairy foods, inhibit the growth of certain cells in the colon. But this effect was not entirely consistent for the various indicators of cell growth. Furthermore, it is not clear whether these presumably favorable biochemical effects really lead to less cancer growth. Another research group demonstrated that calcium does reduce the presumably dangerous bile acids, but they also observed that a high-wheat diet did an even better job of reducing them. But, and this is the really odd part, when a combination high-calcium and high-wheat diet was consumed, the binding effect on bile acids was weaker than for each individual supplement taken alone. It just goes to show that when individually observed nutrient effects are combined, as in a dietary situation, the expected may become the unexpected. I doubt that a high-calcium diet obtained through calcium supplements or through calcium-rich cow's milk has a beneficial effect on colon cancer. In rural China, where calcium consumption was modest and almost no dairy food was consumed at the time of our survey, colon cancer rates were not higher. Instead, they were much lower than in the U.S. The parts of the world that consume the most calcium, Europe and North America, have the highest rates of colorectal cancer. Another lifestyle choice that is clearly important for this disease is exercise. Increased exercise is convincingly associated with less colorectal cancer. In one summary from the World Cancer Research Fund and the American Institute for Cancer Research, 17 out of 20 studies found that exercise protected against colon cancer. Screening for trouble. The benefits of exercise bring me back to former President George W. Bush. He was known to enjoy staying physically fit with a regular running routine, and that is undoubtedly one of the reasons why he received a clean bill of health when he had a colonoscopy. But what is a colonoscopy anyway? And is it really worth the effort to get checked? When people go to the doctor to get a colonoscopy, the doctor inspects the large bowel using a rectal probe and looks for abnormal tissue growth. The most commonly found abnormality is a polyp. Although it is not yet clear exactly how tumors are related to polyps, most scientists would agree that they share similar dietary associations and genetic characteristics. Those people who have non-cancerous problems in the large bowel, such as polyps, often are the same people who later develop cancerous tumors. So getting screened for polyps or other problems is a reasonable way to establish risk for large bowel cancer in the future. But what if you have a polyp? What is the best thing to do? Will surgical removal of the polyp lessen colon cancer risk? A nationwide study has shown that when polyps were removed, there was a 76 to 90% decrease in the expected cases of colon cancer. This certainly supports the idea of routine screening. It is commonly recommended that people get a colonoscopy once every 10 years, starting at the age of 50. If you have a higher risk of colorectal cancer, it is recommended that you start at the age of 40 and screen more frequently. How do you know if you are at a higher risk for colorectal cancer? We can very roughly assess our personal genetic risk in several ways. We can consider the probability of our getting colon cancer based on the number of immediate family members who already have the disease. We can screen for the presence of polyps, and we now can clinically test for the presence of suspect genes. This is an excellent example of how genetic research can lead to a better understanding of complex diseases. However, in the enthusiasm for studying the genetic basis for this cancer, two things often get overlooked. First, the proportion of colon cancer cases attributed to known inherited genes is only about 1 to 3%. Another 10 to 30% tend to occur in some families more than others, called familial clustering, an effect possibly reflecting a significant genetic contribution. These numbers, however, exaggerate the number of cancers that are solely due to genes. Except for the very few people whose colon cancer risk is largely determined by known inherited genes, 1 to 3%, most of the family-connected colon cancer cases, that is, the additional 10 to 30%, are still largely determined by environmental and dietary factors. After all, place of residence and diet are often shared experiences within families. Even if you have a high genetic risk, a healthy plant-based diet is capable of negating most, if not all, of that risk by controlling the expression of these genes. Because a high-fiber diet can only prevent colon cancer, extra fiber won't ever promote colon cancer. Dietary recommendations should be the same, regardless of one's genetic risk. Prostate cancer. I suspect that most people do not know exactly what a prostate is, even though prostate cancer is commonly discussed. The prostate is a male reproductive organ about the size of a walnut, located between the bladder and the colon. It is responsible for producing some of the fluid that helps sperm on its quest to fertilize the egg. For such a little thing, it sure can cause a lot of problems. Several of my friends now have prostate cancer or closely related conditions, and they aren't alone. As a 1998 report pointed out, prostate cancer is one of the most commonly diagnosed cancers among men in the United States, representing about 25% of all tumors. As many as half of all men 70 years and older have latent prostate cancer, a silent form of the cancer that is not yet causing discomfort. Prostate cancer is not only extremely prevalent, but also slow-growing. Only 7% of diagnosed prostate cancer victims die within 5 years. This makes it difficult to know how and if the cancer should be treated. The main question for the patient and doctor is, will this cancer become life-threatening before death comes from other causes? One of the markers used to determine the likelihood of prostate cancer becoming life-threatening is the blood level of prostate-specific antigen, PSA. Men are diagnosed as having prostate problems when their PSA levels are above 4. But this test alone is hardly a firm diagnosis of cancer, especially if the PSA level is barely above 4. The ambiguity of this test leads to some very difficult decision-making. Occasionally, my friends ask for my opinion. Should they have a little surgery or a lot? Is a PSA value of 6.0 a serious problem or just a wake-up call? If it's a wake-up call, then what must they do to reduce such a number? While I cannot speak to the clinical condition of an individual, I can speak to the research, and of the research I have seen, there is no doubt that diet plays a key role in this disease. Although there is debate regarding the specifics of diet and this cancer, let's start with some very safe assumptions that have long been accepted in the research community. Prostate cancer rates vary widely between different countries, even more than breast cancer. High prostate cancer rates primarily exist in societies with Western diets and lifestyles. In developing countries, men who adopt Western eating practices or move to Western countries suffer more prostate cancer. These disease patterns are similar to those of other diseases of affluence. Mostly, this tells us that although prostate cancer certainly has a genetic component, environmental factors play the dominant role. So what environmental factors are important? You can guess that I'm going to say plant-based foods are good and animal-based foods are bad. But do we know anything more specific? Surprisingly, one of the most consistent, specific links between diet and prostate cancer has been dairy consumption. A 2001 Harvard review of the research could hardly be more convincing. 12 of 14 case-control studies and 7 of 9 cohort studies have observed a positive association for some measure of dairy products and prostate cancer. This is one of the most consistent dietary predictors for prostate cancer in the published literature. In these studies, men with the highest dairy intakes had approximately double the risk of total prostate cancer, and up to a fourfold increase in risk of metastatic or fatal prostate cancer relative to low consumers. Let's consider that again. Dairy intake is one of the most consistent dietary predictors for prostate cancer in the published literature. And those who consume the most dairy have double to quadruple the risk. Another review of published literature done in 1998 reached a similar conclusion. In ecologic data, correlations exist between per capita meat and dairy consumption and prostate cancer mortality rate, one study cited. In case control and prospective studies, the major contributors of animal protein, meats, dairy products, and eggs have frequently been associated with a higher risk of prostate cancer, 23 studies cited. Of note, numerous studies have found an association primarily in older men, 6 studies cited, though not all, 1 study cited. The consistent associations with dairy products could result from, at least in part, their calcium and phosphorus content. In other words, an enormous body of evidence shows that animal-based foods are associated with prostate cancer. In the case of dairy, the high intake of calcium and phosphorus also could be partly responsible for this effect. This research leaves little room for dissent. Each of the studies just mentioned represents analyses of over a dozen individual studies, providing an impressive bulk of convincing literature. The mechanisms. As we have seen with other forms of cancer, large-scale observational studies show a link between prostate cancer and an animal-based diet, particularly one based heavily on dairy. Understanding the mechanisms behind the observed link between prostate cancer and dairy clinches the argument. The first mechanism concerns a hormone that increases cancer cell growth, a hormone that our bodies make as needed. This growth hormone, insulin-like growth factor 1, IGF-1, is turning out to be a predictor of cancer, just as cholesterol is a predictor for heart disease. Under normal conditions, this hormone efficiently manages the rates at which cells grow, that is, how they reproduce themselves and how they discard old cells, all in the name of good health. Under unhealthy conditions, however, IGF-1 becomes more active, increasing the birth and growth of new cells while simultaneously inhibiting the removal of old cells, both of which favor the development of cancer, 7 studies cited. So what does this have to do with the food we eat? It turns out that consuming animal-based foods increases the blood levels of this growth hormone, IGF-1. With regard to prostate cancer, people with higher than normal blood levels of IGF-1 have been shown to have 5.1 times the risk of advanced stage prostate cancer. There's more. When men also have low blood levels of a protein that binds and inactivates, IGF-1, they will have 9.5 times the risk of advanced stage prostate cancer. Let's put a few stars by these numbers. They are big and impressive, and fundamental to this finding is the fact that we make more IGF-1 when we consume animal-based foods like meat and dairy. The second mechanism relates to vitamin D metabolism. Under most conditions, this vitamin is not a nutrient that we need to consume. Our body can make all that we need simply by being in sunlight 15 to 30 minutes every couple of days. In addition to the production of vitamin D being affected by sunlight, it is also affected by the food that we eat. The formation of the most active form of vitamin D is a process that is closely monitored and controlled by our bodies. This process is a great example of our body's natural balancing act, affecting not only prostate cancer, but breast cancer, colon cancer, osteoporosis, and autoimmune diseases like type 1 diabetes. Because of its importance for multiple diseases, and because of the complexity involved in explaining how it all works, I have provided in Appendix C an abbreviated scheme, just enough to illustrate my point. This web of reactions illustrates many similar and highly integrated reaction networks showing how food controls health. The main component of this process is an active form of vitamin D produced in the body from the vitamin D that we get from food or sunshine. This active or supercharged D produces many benefits throughout the body, including the prevention of cancer, autoimmune diseases, and diseases like osteoporosis. This all-important supercharged D is not something that you get from food or from a drug. A drug composed of isolated supercharged D would be far too powerful and far too dangerous for medical use. Your body uses a carefully composed series of controls and sensors to produce just the right amount of supercharged D for each task at exactly the right time. As it turns out, our diet can determine how much of this supercharged D is produced and how it works once it is produced. Animal protein that we consume has the tendency to block the production of supercharged D, leaving the body with low levels of this vitamin D in the blood. If these low levels persist, prostate cancer can result. Also, persistently high intakes of calcium create an environment where supercharged D declines, thus adding to the problem. So what food substance has both animal protein and large amounts of calcium? Milk and other dairy foods. This fits in perfectly with the evidence that links dairy consumption with prostate cancer. This information provides what we call biological plausibility and shows how the observational data fit together. To review the potential mechanisms. Animal protein causes the body to produce more IGF-1, which in turn throws cell growth and removal out of whack, stimulating cancer development. Animal protein suppresses the production of supercharged D. Excessive calcium, as found in milk, also suppresses the production of supercharged D. Supercharged D is responsible for creating a wide variety of health benefits in the body. Persistently low levels of supercharged D create an inviting environment for different cancers, autoimmune diseases, osteoporosis, and other diseases. The important story here is how the effects of food, both good and bad, operate through a symphony of coordinated reactions to prevent diseases like prostate cancer. In discovering the existence of these networks, we sometimes wonder which specific function comes first and which comes next. We tend to think of these reactions within the network as independent. But this surely misses the point. What impresses me is the multitude of reactions working together in so many ways to produce the same effect. In this case, to prevent disease. There is no single mechanism that fully explains what causes diseases such as cancer. Indeed, it would be foolish to even think along these lines. But what I do know is this: the totality and breadth of the evidence, operating through highly coordinated networks, supports the conclusions that consuming dairy and meat are serious risk factors for prostate cancer. Dr. Ornish's work on prostate cancer. Since the publication of the first edition of the China Study, some of the most compelling new research on the potential impact of a plant-based diet has been on prostate cancer. Dr. Dean Ornish, who demonstrated reversal of advanced heart disease through a plant-based diet in a randomized controlled trial, used the same intervention on men with early-stage prostate cancer. Instead of surgery, radiation, or medication, these men had chosen watchful waiting, meaning they were simply monitoring markers of cancer for signs of progressing disease. As mentioned, prostate cancer tends to grow slowly, and the treatments we use often have permanent side effects, so some men with early prostate cancer elect to monitor the disease rather than intervene immediately. Dr. Ornish put one group of these men on a program consisting of a WFPB diet, stress reduction, group support, and exercise, and prescribed standard care for another group. Average PSA levels declined over the course of 12 months in the diet and lifestyle group, compared to the standard care group. Further, their blood actually repressed cancer growth in cell cultures far, far more than the control group's blood. After 3 months of the diet and lifestyle intervention, these men were noted to have a significant change in the expression of over 500 genes. Also, genes known to promote cancer were suppressed. Over the course of 2 years, 27% of men in the standard care group required conventional treatment, surgery, radiation, or chemotherapy, while only 5% in the diet and lifestyle group required conventional treatment. In short, Dr. Ornish has now shown for early-stage prostate cancer what he demonstrated for advanced heart disease. Diet and lifestyle change alone can halt and even reverse this terrible disease. At this point, it should come as no surprise that recent research has found that men who have been diagnosed with prostate cancer, who consume a more Western diet, more processed and red meats, high-fat dairy, and refined grains, have 2.5 times the risk of dying from their cancer within 10 years. Men with prostate cancer consuming 3 or more servings of dairy products, compared to those consuming less than 1 serving a day, have a 141% increased risk of dying from their cancer within 10 years. Between Dr. Ornish's powerful intervention research findings and previous observational research, it has become very difficult to deny a strong effect of diet and lifestyle on prostate cancer prevention and treatment. In Tom's opinion, as a medical practitioner, we have such conclusive evidence, including observational, mechanistic, and intervention data, that every doctor should tell every man with prostate cancer to stop consuming dairy immediately and embrace a WFPB diet. Bringing it together. Over 500,000 Americans this year will go to the doctor's office and be told that they have cancer of the breast, prostate, or large bowel. People who get one of these cancers represent 40% of all new cancer patients. These three cancers devastate the lives of not only the victims themselves, but also their family and friends. When my mother-in-law died of colon cancer at the age of 51, none of us knew very much about nutrition or what it meant for health. It wasn't that we didn't care about the health of our loved ones. Of course we did. We just didn't have the information. Yet over 40 years later, not much has changed. Of the people you know who have cancer or are at risk of having cancer, how many of them have considered the possibility of adopting a WFPB diet to improve their chances? I'm guessing very few of them have done so. Probably they, too, don't have the information. Our institutions and information providers are failing us. Even cancer organizations, at both the national and local level, are reluctant to discuss or even believe this evidence. Food as a key to health represents a powerful challenge to conventional medicine, which is fundamentally built on drugs, radiation, and surgery. See Part 4. The widespread communities of nutrition professionals, researchers, and doctors are, as a whole, either unaware of this evidence or reluctant to share it. Because of these failings, Americans are being cheated out of information that could save their lives. There is enough evidence now that doctors should be discussing the option of pursuing dietary change as a potential path to cancer prevention and treatment. There is enough evidence now that the U.S. government should be discussing the idea that the toxicity of our diet is the single biggest cause of cancer. There is enough evidence now that local breast cancer alliances and prostate and colon cancer institutions should be discussing the possibility of providing information to Americans everywhere on how a WFPB diet may be an incredibly effective anti-cancer medicine. If these discussions were to happen, it is possible that, next year, fewer than 500,000 people would go to the doctor's office and be told they have cancer of the breast, prostate, or large bowel. The year after that, even fewer friends, co-workers, and family members would be given the most dreaded of all diagnoses. And the following year, even fewer. The possibility that this future could be our reality is real. And as long as this future holds such promise for the health of people everywhere, it is a future worth working for. Chapter 9. Autoimmune Diseases. No group of diseases is more insidious than autoimmune diseases. They are difficult to treat, and progressive loss of physical and mental function is a common outcome. Unlike heart disease, cancer, obesity, and type 2 diabetes, with autoimmune diseases, the body systematically attacks itself. The afflicted patient is almost guaranteed to lose. 250,000 people in the U.S. are diagnosed with one of the more than 80 separate autoimmune diseases each year. Women are 2.7 times more likely to be afflicted than are men. As many as 7 to 10% of people worldwide have an autoimmune disease, amounting to tens of millions in America alone. The more common of these diseases are listed in Chart 9.1. The first nine comprise 97% of all autoimmune disease cases. The most studied are multiple sclerosis, MS, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, type 1 diabetes, and rheumatic heart disease. These are also the primary autoimmune diseases that have been studied in reference to diet. Others not listed in Chart 9.1 include inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's disease, rheumatic heart disease, and, possibly, Parkinson's disease. Each disease name may sound very different, but as one review points out, it is important to consider these disorders as a group. They show similar clinical backgrounds. They sometimes occur in the same person, and they are often found in the same populations. MS and type 1 diabetes, for example, have nearly identical ethnic and geographic distribution. Autoimmune diseases in general become more common the greater the distance from the equator. This phenomenon has been known since 1922. MS, for example, is over 100 times more prevalent in the far north than at the equator. Because of some of these common features, it is not too far-fetched to think of the autoimmune diseases as one grand disease living in different places in the body and taking on different names. We refer in this way to cancer, which is specifically named depending on what part of the body it resides in. All autoimmune diseases are the result of one group of physiological mechanisms gone awry, much like cancer. In this case, the mechanism is the immune system mistakenly attacking cells in its own body. Whether it is the pancreas, as in type 1 diabetes, the myelin sheath, as in MS, or joint tissues, as in arthritis, all autoimmune diseases involve an immune system that has revolted. It is an internal mutiny of the worst kind, one in which our body becomes its own worst enemy. Immunity from invaders. The immune system is astonishingly complex. I often hear people speaking about this system as if it were an identifiable organ like a lung. Nothing could be further from the truth. It is a system, not an organ. In essence, our immune system is like a military network designed to defend against foreign invaders. The soldiers of this network are the white blood cells, which comprise many different subgroups, each having its own mission. These subgroups are analogous to a Navy, Army, Air Force, and Marines, with each group of specialists doing highly specialized work. The recruitment center for the system is in the marrow of our bones. The marrow is responsible for generating specialized cells called stem cells. Some of these cells are released into circulation for use elsewhere in the body. These are called B cells for bone. Other cells formed in the bone marrow remain immature or unspecialized until they travel to the thymus, an organ in the chest cavity just above the heart, where they become specialized. These are called T cells for thymus. These soldier cells, along with other specialized cells, team up to create intricate defense plans. They meet at major intersections around the body, including the spleen, just inside the left lower rib cage, and the lymph nodes. These meeting points are like command and control centers, where the soldier cells rearrange themselves into teams to attack foreign invaders. These cells are remarkably adaptable when they form their teams. They are able to respond to different circumstances and different foreign substances, even those they have never before seen. The immune response to these strangers is an incredibly creative process. It is one of the true wonders of nature. The foreign invaders are protein molecules called antigens. These foreign cells can be a bacterium or a virus looking to corrupt the body's integrity. So when our immune system notices these antigens, it destroys them. Each of these foreign antigens has a separate identity, which is determined by the sequence of amino acids that comprises its proteins. It is analogous to each and every person having a different face. Because numerous amino acids are available for creating proteins, there are infinite varieties of distinctive faces. To counter these antigens, our immune system must customize its defense to each attack. It does this by creating a mirror image protein for each attacker. The mirror image is able to fit perfectly onto the antigen and destroy it. Essentially, the immune system creates a mold for each face it encounters. Every time it sees that face after the initial encounter, it uses the custom-made mold to capture the invader and destroy it. The mold may be a B-cell antibody or a T-cell-based receptor protein. Remembering each defense against each invader is what immunization is all about. An initial exposure to chickenpox, for example, is a difficult battle, but the second time your immune system encounters that virus, it will know exactly how to deal with it, and the war will be shorter, less painful, and much more successful. You may not even get sick. Immunity from ourselves. Even though this system is a wonder of nature when it is defending the body against foreign proteins, it is also capable of attacking the same tissues that it is designed to protect. This self-destructive process is common to all autoimmune diseases. It is as if the body were to commit suicide. One of the fundamental mechanisms for this self-destructive behavior is called molecular mimicry. It so happens that some of the foreign invaders that our soldier cells seek out to destroy look the same as our own cells. The immune system molds that fit these invaders also fit our own cells. The immune system then destroys, under some circumstances, everything that fits the mold, including our own cells. This is an extremely complex, self-destructive process involving many different strategies on the part of the immune system, all of which share the same fatal flaw of not being able to distinguish foreign invader proteins from the proteins of our own body. What does all of this have to do with what we eat? It so happens that the antigens that trick our bodies into attacking our own cells may be in food. During the process of digestion, for example, some proteins slip into our bloodstream from the intestine without being fully broken down into their amino acid parts. The remnants of undigested proteins are treated as foreign invaders by our immune system, which sets about making molds to destroy them and launches the self-destructive autoimmune process. One of the foods that supplies many of the foreign proteins that mimic our own body proteins is cow's milk. Most of the time, our immune system is quite smart. Just like an army arranges for safeguards against friendly fire, the immune system has safeguards to stop itself from attacking the body it's supposed to protect. Even though an invading antigen looks just like one of the cells in our own body, the system can still distinguish our own cells from the invading antigen. In fact, the immune system may use our own cells to practice making molds against the invader antigen without actually destroying the friendly cell. This is analogous to training camps in preparation for war. When our immune system is working properly, we can use the cells in our body that look like the antigens as a training exercise without destroying them, to prepare our soldier cells to repulse the invading antigens. It is one more example of the exceptional elegance of nature's ability to regulate itself. The immune system uses a very delicate process to decide which proteins should be attacked and which should be left alone. The way this incredibly complex process breaks down with autoimmune diseases is not yet understood. We just know that the immune system loses its ability to differentiate between the body's cells and the invading antigen, and instead of using the body's cells for training, it destroys them along with the invaders. Type 1 diabetes. In the case of type 1 diabetes, the immune system attacks the pancreas cells responsible for producing insulin. This devastating, incurable disease mostly strikes children, creating a painful and difficult experience for young families. What most people don't know, though, is that there is strong evidence that this disease is linked to diet, and more specifically, to dairy products. The ability of cow's milk protein to initiate type 1 diabetes is well documented. The possible initiation of this disease goes like this. A baby is not nursed long enough and is fed cow's milk protein, perhaps in an infant formula. The milk reaches the small intestine where it is digested down to its amino acid parts. For some infants, cow's milk is not fully digested, and small amino acid chains or fragments of the original protein remain in the intestine. These incompletely digested protein fragments may be absorbed into the blood. The immune system recognizes these fragments as foreign invaders and goes about destroying them. Unfortunately, some of the fragments look exactly the same as the cells of the pancreas that are responsible for making insulin. The immune system loses its ability to distinguish between the cow's milk protein fragments and the pancreatic cells and destroys them both, thereby eliminating the child's ability to produce insulin. The infant becomes a type 1 diabetic and remains so for the rest of his or her life. This process boils down to a truly remarkable statement. Cow's milk may cause one of the most devastating diseases that can befall a child. For obvious reasons, this is one of the most contentious issues in nutrition today. One of the more remarkable reports on this cow's milk effect was published over two decades ago in 1992 in the New England Journal of Medicine. Finnish researchers obtained blood from type 1 diabetic children aged 4 to 12 years. Then they measured the levels of antibodies that had formed in the blood against an incompletely digested protein of cow's milk called bovine serum albumin, BSA. They did the same process with non-diabetic children and compared the two groups. Remember, an antibody is the mirror image or mold of a foreign antigen. Children who had antibodies to cow's milk protein must have previously consumed cow's milk. It also means that undigested protein fragments of the cow's milk proteins had to have entered the infant's circulation in order to cause antibodies to form in the first place. The researchers discovered something truly remarkable. Of the 142 diabetic children measured, every single one had antibody levels higher than 3.55 IgG. Of the 79 normal children, every single one had antibody levels less than 3.55. In other words, there was no overlap in levels between diabetic and normal children. All of the diabetic children had levels of cow's milk antibodies that were higher than those of all of the non-diabetic children. This implies two things. Children with more antibodies consumed more cow's milk, and increased antibodies may cause type 1 diabetes. These results sent shockwaves through the research community. It was the complete separation of antibody responses that made this study so remarkable. This study, and others done even earlier, initiated an avalanche of additional studies over the next several years that continue to this day. Several studies have since investigated this effect of cow's milk on BSA antibody levels. All but one showed that cow's milk increases BSA antibodies in type 1 diabetic children, although the responses were quite variable in their magnitude. In the decade leading up to the publication of the first edition, scientists had investigated far more than just the BSA antibodies, and a more complete picture is coming into view. Very briefly, it goes something like this. Infants or very young children of a certain genetic background who are weaned from the breast too early onto cow's milk, and who perhaps become infected with a virus that may corrupt the gut immune system, are likely to have a high risk for type 1 diabetes. A study in Chile considered the first two factors, cow's milk and genes. Genetically susceptible children weaned too early onto cow's milk-based formula had a risk of type 1 diabetes that was 13.1 times greater than children who did not have these genes and who were breastfed for at least 3 months, thus minimizing their exposure to cow's milk. Another study in the U.S. showed that genetically susceptible children fed cow's milk as infants had a risk of disease that was 11.3 times greater than children who did not have these genes and who were breastfed for at least 3 months. This 11 to 13 times greater risk is incredibly large, 1,000 to 1,200%. Anything over 3 to 4 times is usually considered very important. To put this in perspective, smokers have approximately 10 times greater risk of getting lung cancer, still less than the 11 to 13 times risk here, and people with high blood pressure and cholesterol have a 2.5 to 3.0 times greater risk of heart disease. See chart 9.2. So how much of the 11 to 13 times increased risk of type 1 diabetes is due to early exposure to cow's milk, and how much is due to genes? These days, there is a popular opinion that type 1 diabetes is due to genetics, an opinion often shared by doctors as well. But genetics alone cannot account for more than a very small fraction of cases of this disease. Genes do not act in isolation. They need a trigger for their effects to be produced. It has also been observed that after one member of identical twin pairs gets type 1 diabetes, there is only a 13 to 33% chance of the second twin getting the disease, even though both twins have the same genes. If it were all due to genes, closer to 100% of the identical twins would get the disease. In addition, it is possible that the 13 to 33% risk for the second twin is due to the sharing of a common environment and diet, factors affecting both twins. Consider, for example, the observation shown in chart 9.3, which highlights the link between one aspect of environment, cow's milk consumption, and this disease. Cow's milk consumption by children 0 to 14 years of age in 12 countries shows an almost perfect correlation with type 1 diabetes. the greater the consumption of cow's milk, the greater the prevalence of type 1 diabetes. In Finland, type 1 diabetes is 36 times more common than in Japan. Large amounts of cow's milk products are consumed in Finland, but very little is consumed in Japan. As we have seen with other diseases of affluence, when people migrate from areas of the world where disease incidence is low to areas of the world where disease incidence is high, they quickly adopt the high incidence rates as they change their diet and lifestyle. This shows that even though individuals may have the necessary genes, the disease will occur only in response to certain dietary and/or environmental circumstances. Disease trends over time show the same thing. The worldwide prevalence of type 1 diabetes is increasing at an alarming rate of 3% per year. This increase is occurring for different populations, even though there may be substantial differences in disease rates. This relatively rapid increase cannot be due to genetic susceptibility. The frequency of any one gene in a large population is relatively stable over time, unless there are changing environmental pressures that allow one group to reproduce more successfully than another group. For example, if all families with type 1 diabetic relatives had a dozen babies, and all families without type 1 diabetic relatives died off, then the gene or genes that may be responsible for type 1 diabetes would become much more common in the population. This, of course, is not what is happening. And the fact that type 1 diabetes is increasing 3% every year is very strong evidence that genes are not solely responsible for this disease. It seems to me that we now have impressive evidence showing that cow's milk may be an important contributor to type 1 diabetes. When the results of all these studies are combined, both genetically susceptible and not susceptible, we find that children weaned too early and fed cow's milk have on average a 50 to 60% higher risk of type 1 diabetes, 1.5 to 1.6 times increased risk. The earlier information on diet and type 1 diabetes was impressive enough to cause two significant developments. The American Academy of Pediatrics in 1994 strongly encouraged that infants and families where diabetes is more common not be fed cow's milk supplements for their first 2 years of life. Second, many researchers have developed prospective studies, the kind that follow individuals into the future, to see if a careful monitoring of diet and lifestyle could explain the onset of type 1 diabetes. Two of the better known of these studies have been underway in Finland, one starting in the late 1980s and the other in the mid-1990s. One has shown that cow's milk consumption increases the risk of type 1 diabetes 5 to 6-fold, while the second tells us that cow's milk increases the development of at least another 3 to 4 antibodies in addition to those presented previously. In a separate study, antibodies to beta-casein, another cow's milk protein, were significantly elevated in bottle-fed infants compared to breastfed infants. Children with type 1 diabetes also had higher levels of these antibodies. In short, of the studies that have reported results, the findings strongly support the danger of cow's milk, especially for genetically susceptible children. Still, a definitive assessment of the association of type 1 diabetes with cow's milk is difficult because the consumption of cow's milk is so common, leaving only a small range of exposures for experimental investigations. And the research undertaken since the first edition of this book has shown the association of type 1 diabetes and dietary factors like cow's milk to be even more complex. Not surprising. Recent research has confirmed that the disease mostly begins in genetically susceptible infants and young children. But genes cannot be the sole cause, because fewer than 10% of genetically positive infants actually incur type 1 diabetes. Something more is needed for its development. Cow's milk, especially consumed in place of or shortly after nursing, still appears to be the strongest dietary factor. there has been some evidence that vitamin D supplementation may reduce disease onset, but this evidence has not been entirely consistent. The controversy of controversy. Imagine looking at the front page of the newspaper and finding the following headline: Cow's milk, the likely cause of lethal type 1 diabetes. Because the reaction would be so strong and the economic impact monumental, this headline won't be written anytime soon, regardless of the scientific evidence. Stifling this headline is accomplished under the powerful label of controversy. With so much at stake and so much information understood by so few people, it is easy to generate and sustain controversy. Controversies are a natural part of science. Too often, however, controversy is not the result of rational scientific debate, but instead reflects a need to delay and distort research results. For example, if I say cigarettes are bad for you and provide a mountain of evidence to support my contention, the tobacco companies might come along and pick out one unsolved detail, and then claim that the whole idea of cigarettes being unhealthy is mired in controversy, thereby nullifying all my conclusions. This is easy to do, because there will always be unsolved details. This is the nature of science. Some groups use controversy to stifle certain ideas, impede constructive research, confuse the public, and turn public policy into babble rather than substance. Sustaining and even emphasizing controversy as a means of discrediting findings that cause economic or social discomfort is one of the greatest sins in science. It can be difficult for the layperson to assess the legitimacy of a highly technical controversy, such as that regarding cow's milk and type 1 diabetes. This is true even if the layperson is interested in reading scientific articles. Consider, for example, a 1999 scientific review of the Cow's Milk Type 1 Diabetes Association. In 10 human studies, all case control, summarized in a paper published as part of a controversial topic series, the authors concluded that 5 of the 10 studies showed a statistically significant positive association between cow's milk and type 1 diabetes, and 5 did not. Obviously, this at first seems to demonstrate considerable uncertainty, going a long way to discredit the hypothesis. However, the 5 studies that were counted as negative did not show that cow's milk decreased type 1 diabetes. These 5 studies showed no statistically significant effect either way. In contrast, there are a total of 5 statistically significant studies, and all 5 showed the same result. Early cow's milk consumption is associated with increased risk of type 1 diabetes. There was only 1 chance in 64 that this was a random or chance result. There are many, many reasons, some seen and some unseen, why an experiment would find no statistically significant relationship between 2 factors, even when a relationship really exists. Perhaps the study didn't include enough people, thus decreasing the sensitivity of the study to detect an effect that really exists. Perhaps most of the subjects had very similar feeding practices, limiting detection of the relationship you might otherwise see. Maybe trying to measure infant feeding practices from years ago was inaccurate enough that it obscured the relationship that does exist. Perhaps the researchers were studying the wrong period of time in an infant's life. The point is, if 5 of the 10 studies did find a statistically significant relationship, and all 5 showed that cow's milk consumption is linked to increasing type 1 diabetes, and none show that cow's milk consumption is linked to decreasing type 1 diabetes, I could hardly justify saying, as the authors of this review did, that the hypothesis has become quite murky with inconsistencies in the literature. In this same review, the authors summarized additional studies that indirectly compared breastfeeding practices associated with cow's milk consumption and type 1 diabetes. This compilation involved 52 possible comparisons, 20 of which were statistically significant. Of these 20 significant findings, 19 favored an association of cow's milk with disease, and only one did not. Again, the odds heavily favored the hypothesized association, something that the authors failed to note. I cite this example not only to support the evidence showing a cow's milk effect on type 1 diabetes, but also to illustrate one tactic that is often used to make something controversial when it is not. This practice is more common than it should be, and is a source of unnecessary confusion. When researchers do this, even if they do it unintentionally, they often have a serious prejudice against the hypothesis in the first place. Indeed, shortly after I wrote this, I heard a brief national public radio interview on the type 1 diabetes problem with the senior author of this review paper. Suffice it to say, the author did not acknowledge the evidence for the cow's milk hypothesis. Because this issue has mammoth financial implications for American agriculture, and because so many people have such intense personal biases against it, it is unlikely that this diabetes research will reach the American media anytime soon. However, the depth and breadth of evidence now implicating cow's milk as a possible contributor of type 1 diabetes is impressive, even though the very complex mechanistic details are not yet fully understood. We not only have evidence of the danger of cow's milk, we also have considerable evidence showing that the association between diabetes and cow's milk is biologically plausible. Human breast milk is the perfect food for an infant, and one of the most damaging things a mother can do is to substitute the milk of a cow for her own. The incidence of type 1 diabetes is rising rapidly in many parts of the world at an annual rate of 3-5%. It is time to become more vigorous in sharing with the public the evidence we have on cow's milk and its products. Waiting for the evidence to be perfect, it never will be, is an unacceptable strategy, especially when cow's milk protein has long been shown to have other effects of serious concern, including increased blood cholesterol, formation of early atherogenesis, cardiovascular disease, and promotion of experimental cancer, among other effects. Multiple sclerosis and other autoimmune diseases. Multiple sclerosis, MS, is a particularly difficult autoimmune disease, both for those who have it and for those who care for its victims. It is a lifelong battle involving a variety of unpredictable and serious disabilities. MS patients often pass through episodes of acute attacks while gradually losing their ability to walk or to see. After 10 to 15 years, they often are confined to a wheelchair and then to a bed for the rest of their lives. About 400,000 people in the U.S. alone have the disease, according to the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. It is a disease that is initially diagnosed between 20 and 40 years of age and strikes women about 3 times more often than men. Even though there is widespread medical and scientific interest in this disease, most authorities claim to know very little about causes or cures. Major multiple sclerosis websites all claim that the disease is an enigma. They generally list genetics, viruses, and environmental factors as possibly playing roles in the development of this disease, but pay almost no heed to a possible role for diet. This is peculiar, considering the wealth of intriguing information on the effects of food that is available from reputable research reports. Once again, cow's milk appears to play an important role. The multiple symptoms of this disease represent a nervous system gone awry. In MS patients, the electrical signals carrying messages to and from the central nervous system, brain and spinal cord, and out through the peripheral nervous system to the rest of the body, are not well coordinated and controlled. This is because the insulating cover or sheath of the nerve fibers, the myelin, is being destroyed by an autoimmune reaction. Think of what would happen to your household wiring if the electrical insulation became thin or was stripped away, leaving bare wires. The electrical signals would be short-circuited. This is what happens with MS. The wayward electrical signals may destroy cells and burn patches of neighboring tissue, leaving little scars or bits of sclerotic tissue. These burns can become serious and ultimately destroy the body.